For years and years and years I wondered, but dared not ask. And then I blundered. I looked behind the mask to find nothing. She had no face. She had become merely a hand holding a mask with grace. So many of us going around as nice dead people because we have been taught a language of domination that makes us moment by moment worrying about what people think we are. Do they think I'm normal, abnormal, kind, unkind, attractive, unattractive? And the more we occupy ourselves at that level, the less we're connected to the life within ourselves, to our human emotions. Psychoanalyst Rollo May suggests that the mature person becomes able to differentiate feelings into as many nuances, strong and passionate experiences, or delicate and sensitive ones, as in the different passages of music in a symphony. For many of us, however, our ability to express feelings, as Rollo May describes it, is limited, like notes in a bugle call. Our repertoire of words for calling people names is much larger, usually, than our vocabulary of words that allow us to clearly describe what's alive in us, our emotional state. I went through 21 years of American schools, and I can't recall at any time being asked the right way to think, end quotes, as defined by feelings were simply not. What was valued was, in quotes, the right way to think, end quotes, as defined by those who held positions of rank and authority. Too often, in my experience, we are trained to be other-directed rather than to be in contact with ourselves. We learn to be up in our head wondering, what is it that others think is right for me to say and do? An interaction I had with a teacher when I was about 9 years old demonstrates how alienation from our feelings can begin. Once I was hiding in a classroom after school was over. It was an hour and a half after school was over. And I was hiding because there were a group of students outside that wanted to punish me because I was Jewish. A teacher found me hiding in the classroom, and she was surprised to see a student still in the school an hour and a half after school was over. She didn't know I was trying to outwait those that were waiting outside for me. And she said, "What are you doing in here? Get out. You're not supposed to be in school this late." And I said, "Those boys outside are waiting to beat me up." She says, "But school is over. You have to go out now." I said, "But I'm afraid." And she said, "Boys don't get afraid." A few years later, I received further reinforcement of this kind of thinking through my participation in athletics. It was typical for coaches to value athletes willing to give their all and continue playing no matter how much physical pain they were in. I learned the lesson so well, I once continued playing baseball for a month with an untreated broken wrist. At a nonviolent communication workshop, a college student spoke about a roommate who played the stereo so loudly it kept him awake. When I asked him to express how he felt when this happened, the student replied, "I feel it isn't right to play music so loud at night." I pointed out that when he followed the word "feel" with the word "that," he was expressing an opinion but not revealing his feelings. I asked him to try again to express his feelings. He responded, "I feel when people do something like that, it's evidence of a personality disturbance." I explained that to me this was still an opinion rather than what he was feeling. He paused thoughtfully and then announced with vehemence, "I don't have any feelings about it." The student obviously had strong feelings. Unfortunately, he didn't know how to become aware of them or to express them. This difficulty in identifying and expressing feelings is common. And in my experience, especially so among lawyers, engineers, police officers, corporate managers, career military personnel, people whose professional codes discourage them from manifesting emotions. For families, the toll is severe when members are unable to communicate emotions. country and western singer Reba McEntire wrote a song after her father's death and titled it "The Greatest Man I Never Knew." In so doing, she'd undoubtedly expressed the sentiments of many people who were never able to establish the emotional connection they would have liked with people in their families. I regularly hear statements like, "I wouldn't want you to get the wrong idea. I'm married to a wonderful man, but I never know how he's feeling." One such dissatisfied woman brought her spouse to a workshop, during which she told him, "I feel like I'm married to a wall." The husband then did an excellent imitation of a wall. He sat mute. Exasperated, she turned to me and said, "See, this is what happens all the time. He sits and says nothing. It's just like living with a wall." I said, "It sounds to me like you're feeling lonely and wanting more emotional contact with your husband." She said, "Yes." And I said, "I'm afraid that when you tell him things like, 'I feel like I'm living with a wall,' notice you're not expressing your feelings when you say that. You're making a diagnosis, and diagnoses like that often lead to self-fulfilling prophecies." When she expressed herself as I suggested she do, by telling her husband how she feels, she says, "I feel frustrated when I need contact with you, and I don't know what you're feeling. Would you be willing to learn how to express your feelings more openly?" When he heard that, the wall turned into a real human being and started to open up and say that he wants to do that, but he would need some help because he didn't have much experience with knowing how to express his feelings. The benefits of strengthening our feeling vocabulary is evident not only in intimate relationships, but also in the professional world. I was once hired to consult with the members of a technological department of a large Swiss corporation, troubled by the discovery that workers in other departments were avoiding them. When asked why, employees from other departments responded, "We hate going there to consult with those people. It's like talking to a bunch of machines." The problem abated when I spent time with the members of the technological department, encouraging them to express more of their humanness in their communications with coworkers. In another instance, I was working with the administrators of a hospital, who were anxious about a forthcoming meeting with the hospital's physicians. They wanted support for a project that the physicians had only recently turned down by a vote of 17-1. The administrators were eager to have me demonstrate how they might use nonviolent communication when approaching the physicians. Assuming the voice of an administrator in a role-playing session, they prepared, "I'm feeling frightened to be bringing up this issue. I chose to start this way because I sensed how frightened the administrators were as they prepared to confront the physicians." Before I could continue, however, one of the administrators stopped me to protest, "You can't say you're frightened in that way. You're being unrealistic. We could never say that." When I asked why an admission of fear seemed so impossible, he replied without hesitation, "If we admitted we're frightened, they'd pick us to pieces." His answer didn't surprise me. I've often heard people say how they cannot imagine ever expressing feelings at their workplace. I was pleased to learn, however, that one of the administrators did decide to risk expressing his vulnerability at the dreaded meeting. Instead of his customary manner of appearing strictly logical, rational, and unemotional, he chose to state his feelings together with reasons for wanting the physicians to change their position. He noticed how differently the physicians responded to him. In the end, he was amazed and relieved when, instead of being picked to pieces, as he had expected might happen, they reversed their previous position, voting 17-1 now to support the project. This dramatic turnaround helped the administrators realize and appreciate the potential impact of expressing one's vulnerability, even in the workplace. I would like to talk now about when the use of force might be chosen. Many times people are surprised when I say that because they think that somehow nonviolence means that we cannot use force. It does require, however, knowing the difference between the protective use of force, which I see is in harmony with nonviolence, and not getting that mixed up with the punitive use of force. when two disputing parties have each had an opportunity to fully express what they are feeling and needing and requesting, and each has empathized with the other, my experience has been that a resolution can be reached that meets the needs of both sides. At the very least, the two can agree in goodwill to disagree. In some situations, however, the opportunity for such a dialogue may not exist, and the use of force may be necessary to protect life or individual rights. For instance, the other party may be unwilling to communicate, or imminent danger may not allow time for communication. In these situations, we may need to resort to force. If we do, though, as I say, it's important not to get mixed up the protective use of force and the punitive use of force. The intention behind the protective use of force is to prevent injury or injustice. The intention behind the punitive use of force is to cause individuals to suffer for their perceived misdeeds. When we grab a child who's running into the street to prevent the child from being injured, we're applying protective force. The punitive use of force, on the other hand, might involve physical or psychological attack, such as spanking the child, or reproofs like, "How could you be so stupid? You should be ashamed of yourself." When we focus on the protective use of force, we're focusing on the life or rights we want to protect, without passing judgment on either the person or the behavior. We're not blaming or condemning the child rushing into the street. Our thinking is solely directed toward protecting the child from danger. For application of this kind of force in social and political conflicts, see Robert Irwin's book, Nonviolent Social Defense. The assumption behind the protective use of force is that people behave in ways injurious to themselves and others out of a form of ignorance. The corrective process is therefore one of education, not punishment. Ignorance includes A, a lack of awareness of the consequences of our actions, B, an inability to see how our needs may be met without injury to others, C, the belief that we have the right to punish or hurt others because they deserve it, and D, delusional thinking that involves, for example, hearing a voice that instructs us to kill someone. Punitive action, on the other hand, is based on the assumption that people commit offenses because they are bad or evil, and to correct the situation, they need to be made to repent. Their correction is undertaken through punitive action designed to make them, 1, suffer enough to see the error of their ways, 2, repent, and 3, change. In practice, however, punitive action, rather than evoking repentance and learning, is just as likely to generate resentment and hostility, and to reinforce resistance to the very behavior we are seeking. Physical punishment, such as spanking, is one punitive use of force. I have found the subject of corporal punishment to provoke strong sentiments among parents. Some adamantly defend the practice while referring to the Bible. "Spare the rod, spoil the child." Parents say to me, "It's because we don't spank that delinquency is now rampant." They are persuaded that spanking our children shows that we love them by setting clear boundaries. Other parents are equally insistent that spanking is unloving and ineffective because it teaches children that when all else fails, we can always resort to physical violence. My personal concern is that children's fear of corporal punishment may obscure their awareness of the compassion that underlies parental demands. Parents often tell me they have to use punitive force because they see no other way to influence their children to, in quotes, do what's good for them, end quotes. They support their opinion with anecdotes of children expressing appreciation for seeing the light after having been punished. Having raised my own children, I empathize deeply with parents regarding the daily challenges they face in educating children and keeping them safe. This does not, however, lessen my concern about the use of physical punishment. First, I wonder whether people who proclaim the successes of punishment are aware of the countless instances of children who turn against what might be good for them simply because they choose to fight rather than succumb to coercion. Second, the apparent success of corporal punishment in influencing a child doesn't mean that other means of influence wouldn't have worked equally well or better. Finally, I share the concerns of many parents about the social consequences of using physical punishment. When parents opt to use punitive force, we may win the battle of getting children to do what we want. But in the process, are we not perpetuating a social norm that justifies violence as a means of resolving differences? In addition to the physical, other uses of force also qualify as punishment. One is the use of blame to discredit another person. For example, a parent may label a child as wrong, selfish, immature, when a child doesn't behave in a certain way. Another form of punitive force is the withholding of some means of gratification, such as parents' curtailing of allowance or driving privileges. In this type of punishment, the withdrawal of caring or respect is one of the most powerful threats of all. When we submit to doing something solely for the purpose of avoiding punishment, our attention is distracted from the value of the action itself. Instead, we are focusing upon the consequences of what might happen if we fail to take that action. If a worker's performance is prompted by fear of punishment, the job gets done, but morale suffers. Sooner or later, productivity will decrease. Self-esteem is also diminished when punitive force is used. If children brush their teeth because they fear shame and ridicule, their oral health may improve, but their self-respect will develop cavities. Furthermore, as we all know, punishment is costly in terms of goodwill. The more we are seen as agents of punishment, the harder it is for others to respond compassionately to our needs. Many of us do not receive gratitude very well. We fret over whether we deserve it. We worry about what's being expected of us, especially if we have had teachers or managers who have used gratitude as a means to spur productivity. Or we're nervous about living up to what we see as expectations behind the gratitude. Accustomed to a culture where buying, earning, and deserving are the standard modes of interchange, we are often uncomfortable with simple giving and receiving. Nonviolent communication encourages us to receive gratitude with the same quality of empathy we express when listening to any message. We hear what we've done that's contributed to the other's well-being. We hear their feelings and the needs that were fulfilled. We take into our hearts the joyous reality that we can each enhance the quality of others' lives. I was taught to receive appreciation with grace by my friend Nafez Asseli. He was a member of a Palestinian team whom I had invited to Switzerland for training in nonviolent communication. At the end of the workshop, Nafez came up to me, said, "This training will be very valuable for us in working for peace in my country." He said, "I would like to thank you in a way that we Sufis do when we want to express special appreciation for something." Locking his thumb onto mine, he looked me in the eye and said, "I kiss the God in you that allows you to give us what you did." He then kissed my hand. Nafez's expression of gratitude showed me a different way to receive gratitude. Usually it's received from one of two polar positions. At one end, what we call egotism, believing ourselves to be superior because we've been given this gratitude. At the other extreme is false humility, denying the importance of the appreciation by shrugging it off and saying things, "Oh, it's nothing." Nafez showed me that I could receive appreciation and gratitude joyfully in the awareness that what I had been given enabled me to enrich the lives of others. If I am aware that it is this power of a divine energy working through each of us that gives us the power to enrich lives for others, then I would avoid the ego trap and the false humility poles. Golda Meir, when she was the Israeli prime minister, once chided one of her ministers who couldn't receive the gratitude except to try to be humble about it. She said, "Don't be so humble. You're not that great." The following lines that I read in a book by Marianne Williamson serve as another reminder for me to avoid the pitfall of false humility. It also helps me to understand why so many people have fear receiving gratitude. In her book, she writes, "Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that frightens us. You are a child of God. Your playing small doesn't serve the world. There's nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We were born to make manifest the glory of God that is within us. It's not just in some of us, it is in everyone. And as we let our own light shine, we consciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our fear, our presence automatically liberates others." Paradoxically, despite our unease in receiving gratitude, most of us yearn to be genuinely recognized for what we have done. During a surprise party for me, a 12-year-old friend of mine suggested a party game to help introduce the guests to each other. We were to write down a question, drop it in a box, and then take turns with each person drawing out a question and responding to it out loud. Having recently consulted with various social service agencies and industrial organizations, I was feeling struck by how often people expressed a hunger for gratitude being expressed on their jobs. I heard over and over variations on the theme, "No matter how hard you work, you never hear a good word from anybody, but make one mistake and there's always somebody jumping all over you." So for this game that was suggested, I wrote the question, "What gratitude might someone express that would leave you jumping for joy?" A woman drew that question out of the box, read it, and started to cry. As director of a shelter for battered women, she would put considerable energy each month into creating a schedule to please as many staff members as possible. Yet each time the schedule was presented, at least a couple of individuals would complain. She couldn't remember ever receiving gratitude for her efforts to design a fair schedule. All this had flashed through her mind as she read my question, and the hunger for gratitude brought tears to her eyes. Upon hearing the woman's story, another friend of mine said that he too would like to answer that question. Everyone else then also wanted to take a turn. As they responded to the question, several people wept. While the craving for gratitude, as opposed to manipulative praise and compliments, is particularly evident in the workplace, it affects family life as well. One evening when I pointed out this failure to perform a house chore, my son Brett retorted, "Dad, are you aware how often you bring up what's going wrong but almost never bring up what's gone right?" His observation stayed with me. I realized how I was continually searching for improvements, while too infrequently stopping to celebrate things that were going as I would like. I had just completed a workshop with over 100 participants, all of whom had evaluated it very highly with the exception of one person. However, what lingered in my mind was what that one person had written. That evening, as I deliberated on how often it's the things we have not done that we would like to have done that stay with us, rather than celebrating what we did do, I wrote a song that began, "If I'm 98% perfect on anything I do, it's the 2% I've messed up I'll remember when I'm through." It occurred to me that I had a choice to adopt instead the outlook of a teacher I knew. One of her students, having neglected to study for an exam, had resigned himself to turning in a blank piece of paper with his name at the top. He was surprised when she later returned the test to him with a grade of 14%. "What did I get 14% for?" he asked incredulously. "Neatness," she replied. Ever since my son Brett's wake-up call, I've tried to be more aware of what others are doing that enriches my life and to make sure that it gets expressed. I was deeply touched by a passage in John Powell's book, The Secret of Staying in Love, in which he describes his sadness over having been unable during his father's lifetime to express the gratitude he felt for him. How sad it seemed to me to miss the chance of expressing gratitude to the people who have been the greatest positive influences in our lives. Immediately an uncle of mine, Julius Fox, came to mind. When I was a boy, he came daily to offer nursing care to my grandmother, who was totally paralyzed. While he cared for my grandmother, he always had a warm and loving smile on his face. No matter how unpleasant the task may have appeared to my boyish eyes, he treated her as if she were doing him the greatest favor she could do by letting him take care of her. This provided a wonderful model of masculine strength for me, one that I've often called upon in the years since. I realized that I had never expressed my gratitude to him. And now I realize that he was now ill and near death. I considered to express my gratitude, but sensed my resistance. I said to myself, I'm sure he already knows how much he means to me. I don't need to express it out loud. Besides, it might embarrass him if I put it into words. As soon as these thoughts entered my head, I knew they weren't true. Too often I had assumed that others knew the intensity of my gratitude, only to discover otherwise. And even when people were embarrassed, they still wanted to hear the gratitude verbalized. Still hesitant, I told myself that words wouldn't do justice to the depth of what I wished to communicate. I quickly saw through that one, though. Yes, words may be poor vehicles in conveying our heartfelt realities, but as I have learned, anything that's worth doing is worth doing poorly. As it happened, I soon found myself seated next to Uncle Julius at a family gathering, and the words simply flowed out of me. He took them in joyfully, without embarrassment. Brimming over with feelings from the evening, I went home, composed a poem, and sent it to him. I was later told that, after receiving my poem, he asked that it be read to him each of the following days until he died 3 weeks later. I once asked this uncle how he had developed such a remarkable capacity to give compassionately. He seemed honored by my question, which he pondered before replying, and then he said, I've been blessed with good teachers. When I asked who they were, he said, Well, your grandmother was the best teacher I had. You lived with her when she was already ill, so you didn't know what she was really like. For example, did your mother ever tell you about the time during the Depression when she brought a tailor and his wife and two children to live with the family for 3 years, after he had lost his house and business in the Depression? I remembered that story well. It had left a deep impression when my mother first told it to me, because I could never figure out where grandmother had found space for the Taylor's family when she was raising 9 children of her own in a pretty small house. Uncle Julius recollected my grandmother's compassion in a few more anecdotes, all of which I had heard as a child. Then he asked, Well, then, surely your mother told you about Jesus. I said, About who? Jesus. I said, No, Uncle Julius, she never told me about Jesus. The story about Jesus was the final precious gift I received from my uncle before he died. It's a true story of a time when a man came to my grandmother's back door asking for some food. This wasn't unusual. Although grandmother was very poor, the entire neighborhood knew that she would feed anyone who showed up at her door. The man who came to the door had a beard and wild, scraggly black hair. His clothes were ragged, and he wore a cross around his neck fashioned out of branches tied with a rope. My grandmother invited him into her kitchen for some food. While he was eating, she asked his name. He replied, My name is Jesus, she asked. Do you have a last name? I'm Jesus the Lord. My grandmother's English wasn't too good. Another uncle came in the room while this man was still eating, and grandmother introduced the stranger as Mr. the Lord. As he continued to eat, my grandmother asked where he lived, and he replied, I don't have a home. She asked, Well, where are you going to stay tonight? It's cold. He said, I don't know. She said, Would you like to stay here? He stayed 7 years. I called my mother that night, and I said, "Mother, why did you never tell me the story about Jesus?" My mother said, "Oh, my goodness, there was a story like that every day I could tell you about your grandmother. I thought I had told you that one." When it came to communicating nonviolently, my grandmother was a natural. She didn't think of what this man was. If she did, she probably would have judged him as crazy and gotten rid of him. No, my grandmother thought in terms of what people feel and what they need. If they're hungry, feed them. If they're without a roof over their head, give them a place to sleep. One other thing I'd like to tell you about my grandmother. She loved to dance. And my mother remembers her saying often, "Never walk when you can dance." I would like to end this program on nonviolence and compassion with a poem I wrote about my grandmother after talking to my uncle that night. I wrote it in honor of my grandmother, who spoke and lived naturally the language of nonviolent communication. One day a man named Jesus came around to my grandmother's door. He asked for a little food. She gave him more. He said he was Jesus the Lord. She didn't check him out with Rome. He stayed for several years, as many did, without a home. It was in her Jewish way. She taught me what Jesus had to say. In that precious way, she taught me what Jesus had to say. And that's, feed the hungry, heal the sick, then take a rest. Never walk when you can dance. Make your home a cozy nest. Yes, it was in her Jewish way. She taught me what Jesus had to say. In her precious way, she taught me what Jesus had to say.
This concludes Nonviolent Communication, A Language of Life with Marshall Rosenberg. Music by Stephen McNamara. For more information on the work of Marshall Rosenberg, please contact him via www.nonviolentcommunication.com. If you would like additional copies of this audio learning series, or to receive a free catalog of audio, video, and music for the inner life, please visit Sounds True on the World Wide Web, www.soundstrue.com, or call 1-800-333-9185, or write the Sounds True catalog, P.O. Box 8010, Boulder, Colorado, 80306. Thank you for listening.
I'd like to talk about the difference between requests and demands. When we do make requests, it's very important that other people receive them as requests and not as demands. When received as a request, it's a gift because it gives the other person an opportunity to do what we human beings love to do, to contribute to one another's well-being. But we don't like to hear demands. This threatens our autonomy. So what is the difference between a request and a demand? Well, as I'm using the term, a demand is when a person believes that if they don't do what the other person is requesting, that in some way they will be punished, they will be rejected, guilted, shamed. When people see a request as a demand, they have two options, submission or rebellion. Either way, the person requesting what is wanted is perceived as coercive, and the listener's capacity to respond compassionately is diminished. The more we have in the past blamed, punished, or laid guilt trips on others when they haven't responded to our request, the higher the likelihood that our requests will now be heard as demands. We also pay for the use of such tactics by others. To the degree that people in our lives have been blamed, punished, or urged to feel guilty for not doing what others have requested, it's likely that they're going to carry this baggage to every subsequent relationship and hear a demand in any request. Let's look at two variations of a situation. Jack says to his friend Jane, "I'm lonely and would like you to spend the evening with me." Now, is that a request or a demand? The answer is we don't know until we see how Jack treats Jane if she doesn't comply. Suppose she replies, "Jack, I'm really tired. If you'd like some company, how about finding someone else to be with you this evening?" If Jack then remarks, "How typical of you to be so selfish," his request was in fact a demand. Instead of empathizing with her need to rest, he has blamed her for what she says. Consider a second scenario in this same situation. Jack starts saying, "I'm lonely and would like you to spend the evening with me." Jane says, "Jack, I'm really tired. If you'd like some company, how about finding someone else to be with you tonight?" Jack turns away wordlessly. Jane, sensing he's upset, says, "Is something bothering you?" Jack, "No." Jane, "Come on, Jack. I can sense something's going on. What's the matter?" Jack, "You know how lonely I'm feeling. If you really loved me, you'd spend the evening with me." Again, instead of empathizing with Jane's needs, Jack now interprets Jane's response that she doesn't love him and that she has rejected him. The more we interpret noncompliance as rejection, the more likely our request will be heard as demands. This leads to a self-fulfilling prophecy. For the more people hear demands, the less they enjoy responding to our requests. On the other hand, we would know that Jack's request had been a genuine request, not a demand, if his response to Jane had expressed a respectful recognition of her feelings and needs. So he might have said to her, "So Jane, you're feeling worn out and need some rest this evening." Now, having given her that empathy, if he wanted to try to get her to see another way that they might have both met their needs and looked for a solution, if she had received the empathy first, she could probably have been willing to look for a solution other than not being with him. We can help others trust that we're requesting, not demanding, by indicating that we would only want the person to comply if the person can do so willingly. Thus we might say, "Would you be willing to set the table?" rather than, "I would like you to set the table." However, the most powerful way to communicate that we are making a genuine request is to empathize with people when, for whatever reason, they don't wish to respond to the request. We demonstrate that we're making a request rather than a demand by how we respond when others don't comply. If we're prepared to show an empathic understanding of what prevents someone from doing as we ask, then by my definition, we've made a request, not a demand. Choosing to request rather than demand does not mean we give up when someone says no to our request. It does mean that we don't engage in persuasion until we have empathized with what's preventing the other person from saying yes. Expressing genuine requests also requires an awareness of our objective. If our objective is only to change people and their behavior or to get our way, then nonviolent communication is not an appropriate tool. Nonviolent communication is designed for those of us who would like others to change and respond only when they can do so willingly and compassionately. The objective of nonviolent communication is to establish a relationship based on honesty and empathy. When others trust that our primary commitment is to the quality of the relationship and that we expect this process will fulfill everyone's needs, then they can trust that our requests are true requests and not camouflage demands. A consciousness of this objective is difficult to maintain, especially for parents, teachers, managers, and others, whose work centers around influencing people and obtaining results. During the initial phases of learning this process, we may find ourselves applying the components of nonviolent communication mechanically without awareness of the underlying purpose. And it's important to be continually conscious that the purpose is not to get what we want, but to create the quality of connection that makes compassionate giving possible. Compassionate giving of a kind that allows everyone's needs to get met. Sometimes, however, even when we're conscious of our intent and express our requests with care, people can still hear a demand, especially if their life has been filled full of demands in the past. And this is particularly true when we occupy positions of authority and are speaking with those who have not had good experiences with people in authority in the past. Once the administrator of a high school invited me to demonstrate to teachers how nonviolent communication might be helpful in communicating with students who weren't cooperating as the teachers would have liked. I was asked to meet with 40 students who had been deemed socially and emotionally maladjusted. I was struck by the way such labels serve as self-fulfilling prophecies. If you were a student who had been labeled this way, wouldn't it give you permission to have fun in school? And wouldn't you be inclined to resist whatever was asked of you if you knew you were thought of as socially and emotionally maladjusted? By putting such labels on people, we tend to act toward them in a way that contributes to the very behavior that concerns us, and then we use this as further confirmation of our diagnosis. Since these students knew they had been classified this way, I wasn't surprised that when I walked in, most of them were hanging out the window hollering obscenities at their friends in the courtyard below. I began by making a request. I had to raise my voice to be heard, and I said, "I'd like you all to come on over here and sit down so I can tell you who I am and what I'd like to do today." About half the students came over. I wasn't clear they had all heard me, so I repeated my request. Now everybody came over and sat down, with the exception of two young men who remained draped over the windowsill. Unfortunately, these two were the biggest ones in the class. "Excuse me," I said to them, "would one of you two gentlemen tell me what you heard me say?" One of them turned toward me and said, "Yeah, you said we had to come over there and sit down." I thought to myself, uh-oh, he's heard my request as a demand. Out loud I said, "Sir," I've learned always to say sir to people with biceps like his, especially when one of them had a tattoo on it. I said, "Would you be willing to tell me how I could have let you know what I was wanting so it wouldn't have sounded like I was bossing you around?" He said, "Huh?" You see, he'd been conditioned to expect demands from authority. He wasn't used to my using a different approach of simply making a request. So I said to him, "How can I let you know what I'm wanting from you so it doesn't sound like I don't care about what you'd like?" He thought for a moment. He said, "I don't know." I said, "Well, what's going on between you and me right now is a good example of what I was wanting us to talk about today. I believe..." So, the other person. How can I tell you what I want in a way that you can trust is just what I'm requesting? To my relief, this seemed to make sense to the young man, who together with his friend came over to join the group. In certain situations such as this one, it might take a while before the person trusts that our requests are requests and not demands. When making a request, it's also helpful to scan our minds for thoughts of the following sort that automatically transform requests into demands. For example, if we have a should in our head, "He should be cleaning up after himself," whatever we ask for is going to probably be a demand. If we're thinking, "She's supposed to do what I ask," again, that'll probably be heard as a demand. If I say, "I deserve to get a raise," probably what I ask for will be a demand. "I'm justified in having them stay later," probably will be heard as a demand. "I have a right to more time off," whatever I request will probably be heard as a demand. When we frame our needs in this way, we are bound to judge others when they don't do as we request. Any time we have words like should, supposed to, deserve, justified, etc.
This concludes Session 2. Our program continues with Session 3.
Finally, let me share a personal incident that taught me the effects of hiding our feelings. I was teaching a course in nonviolent communication to a group of inner-city students. When I walked into the room the first day, the students, who had been enjoying a lively conversation with each other, became quiet, looked down, looked out the window. They didn't look at all interested in being there. I said good morning, and in the silence, I felt very uncomfortable. I didn't feel connection with them, but I was afraid to express it. Instead, I proceeded in my most professional manner by saying, "For this class, we will be studying a process of communication that I hope you will find helpful in your relationships at home and with your friends." I continued to present information about the process, but no one seemed to be listening. One girl, rummaging through her bag, fished out a file and began vigorously filing her nails. Students near the windows glued their faces to the pane as if fascinated by what was going on in the street below. I felt increasingly more uncomfortable, yet I didn't say it. I just continued on. Finally, a student who had certainly more courage than I was demonstrating piped up, "You just hate being with black people, don't you?" I was stunned, yet immediately realized how I had contributed to this misperception by hiding my discomfort that I was actually feeling at not getting the connection with them that I'd like. I said, "I am feeling nervous, but not because you're black. My feelings have to do with my not knowing anyone here, and I wanted to be accepted, and when I came in the room, from the reaction I got, it didn't meet my need for acceptance." This expression of my vulnerability had a pronounced effect on the students. They started to ask questions about me, to tell me things about themselves, and they were then much better able to learn what I had to offer about nonviolent communication. A common confusion generated by the English language is our use of the word feel without actually expressing a feeling when we do use the verb. For example, in the sentence, "I feel I didn't get a fair," the word "feel" is followed by "I feel" could be more accurately replaced with "I think." In general, feelings are not being clearly expressed when the word "feel" is followed by words such as "that," "like," "as if" in sentences like, "I feel that you should know better," "I feel like a failure," "I feel as if I'm living with a wall." Also, this is seen in pronouns, I, you, he, she, they, it, saying, "I feel I am constantly on call. I feel it is useless." Or when we follow the word "feel" with names or nouns referring to people. "I feel Amy has been pretty responsible. I feel my boss is being manipulated." So even though the word "feel" is used in these sentences, what follows is not what I would call an emotion or a feeling. In the English language, it isn't necessary at all to use the word "feel" when we are actually expressing a feeling. We can say, "I'm feeling irritated," or simply, "I'm irritated." In nonviolent communication, we distinguish between words that express actual feelings and those that describe what we think we are. A description of what we think we are might be, "I feel inadequate as a guitar player." In this statement, I'm assessing my ability as a guitar player rather than clearly expressing my feelings. What would be an expression of feelings might sound like this. "I feel impatient with myself as a guitar player. I feel disappointed in my guitar playing. I feel frustrated when I play the guitar." The actual feeling behind my assessment of myself as inadequate could therefore be disappointment, impatience, frustration, or some other emotion. So just saying what we think we are doesn't really capture the feeling. Likewise, it's helpful to differentiate between words that describe what we think others are doing around us and words that describe actual feelings. The following are examples of statements that are easily mistaken as expressions of feelings. In fact, they reveal more how we think others are behaving than what we are actually feeling ourselves. Example 1, I feel unimportant to the people with whom I work. The word unimportant describes how I think others are evaluating me, rather than how I'm actually feeling. In this situation, I might feel sad or discouraged. A second example, I feel misunderstood. Here the word misunderstood indicates my assessment of the other person's level of understanding, rather than an actual feeling. In this situation, I might be feeling anxious or annoyed or some other emotion. A third example, I feel ignored. Again, this is a more of an interpretation of the actions of others rather than a clear statement of how we are feeling. No doubt there have been times when we thought we were being ignored and our feeling was relief because we wanted to be left to ourselves. No doubt there were other times, however, when we felt hurt when we thought we were being ignored because we had wanted to be involved. Words like ignored express how we interpret others rather than how we feel. So let me give you some more of these words that I think are often mixed up with feeling words and give quite different connections with other people than if we used words which better express the feelings. So, again, I want to stress the following are not what I would call feeling words. I feel abandoned, abused, attacked, betrayed, cheated, coerced, interrupted, manipulated, neglected, overworked, unwanted, unappreciated, rejected, put down. So when expressing our feelings, it helps to use words that refer to specific emotions rather than words that are vague or general. For example, if we say, I feel good about that, the word good could mean happy, excited, relieved, or any other emotions. Which is good and bad prevent the listener from connecting easily with what we are actually feeling. So I'd like us to check out to see whether I've made clear what are feelings and what are forms of communications that I don't see as feelings. Let me give several statements and see if you feel they are feelings or not, and then I'll tell you what my reaction is. Number 1, after the I feel you don't love me. I would not call that a feeling. Notice the word you comes after the word feel. It wasn't a feeling. When I say I feel you don't love me, I might feel sad, discouraged, might even be angry, depending on how I was interpreting things. So I would not call I feel you don't love me a feeling. Number 2. I'm sad that you're leaving because I really value our connection. I would call this a feeling because of the word sad. Number 3, I feel scared right now. My need for connection is being threatened. I would say a feeling is expressed there by the word scared. Number 4, when you don't greet me, I feel neglected. I would not call that sentence one in which a feeling was expressed because the word neglected is for me not an emotion, it's more an interpretation. I would have preferred it to be sounding something like this. When you don't greet me, I feel sad, hurt, discouraged. Number 5, I'm happy that you can come to my party. I'd say a feeling was expressed here, happy. Number 6, you're disgusting. No, of course I wouldn't call this a feeling. That's a diagnosis of the other person. If I said I feel disgusted right now because my needs aren't getting met, that's different for me than you're disgusting. Number 7. I feel like hitting you. I would not call that a feeling. That tells me what the person has an image of doing. But I don't know whether that person's scared and wanting to protect themselves by hitting the others, whether they're angry. Could be other feelings as well. Number 8. I feel misunderstood. I wouldn't call misunderstood a feeling. It's one of those words, it's more for me a diagnosis of the other person. I don't know whether the speaker's feeling frustrated, annoyed, sad, discouraged, whatever. Number 9. I feel good about what you did for me. Here the word good is more vague than I would like it to be. I would like us to have a richer vocabulary than that. I would like it to have been expressed like I feel deep gratitude, or I feel pleasure, or I feel happy. Not a vague word like good. Number 10, I'm worthless. I would call that a self-judgment, not a feeling. I would have preferred the person to express the feeling more clearly. If they had been feeling, I feel depressed, I would have preferred that. I feel frustrated, discouraged. Now, as important as feelings are, we don't want to just express our feelings. If I say I'm feeling irritated, it's not enough. We don't want to just express our feelings without some other things connected to them. For example, any time we express a feeling of discomfort, we want to connect that to the need which is the cause of the feeling. And we want to add a clear request of what we want from the other person that would alleviate our discomfort. In the next session, I'm going to talk about taking responsibility for our feelings.
This concludes session 1. Our program continues with session 2.
Two questions help us to see why we are unlikely to get what we want by using punishment to change people's behavior. The first question is, what do I want this person to do that's different from what he or she is doing? If we ask only this question, punishment may seem effective because the threat or exercise of punitive force may well influence the person's behavior in ways we want. However, when the second question is asked, it becomes evident that punishment isn't likely to work. The second important question is this: what do I want this person's reasons to be for doing what I'm requesting? We seldom address the latter question, but when we do, we soon realize that punishment and reward interfere with people's ability to do things motivated out of a desire to enrich life for themselves and others. I believe it's critical to be aware of the importance of people's reasons for behaving as we request. For example, blaming or punishing would obviously not be effective strategies if we want children to clean their rooms out of either a desire for order or a desire to contribute to the parents' enjoyment of order. Other children clean their rooms motivated by obedience to authority, because my mom said I had to. They respond out of avoidance of punishment, fear of feeling guilty if they don't, fear of rejection if they don't. Nonviolent communication, however, fosters a level of moral development based on autonomy and interdependence, whereby we acknowledge responsibility for our own actions and our awareness that our own well-being and that of others are one and the same. I'd like to describe how some students and I used protective use of force to bring order into a chaotic situation at an alternative school. This school was designed for students who had dropped out of school or had been expelled from conventional classrooms. The administration and I hoped to demonstrate that a school based on the principles of nonviolent communication would be able to reach these students.